Welcome to Profiles. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and today our guest is Judy Nursejian. Judy is the executive director and one of the founders of the Boston Women's Health Book Collective. She is a co-author of Our Bodies, Ourselves, a book which helped launch the women's health movement of the 1970s. Our Bodies, Ourselves, now in its 8th edition, has sold over 4 million copies and has been translated into 24 foreign editions. Judy served on the board of the National Women's Health Network for 14 years and currently serves as a board member for Public Responsibility in Medicine and Research. Judy, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Judy, tell me a little bit about how you came to be involved in the original group of women that put together the original edition of Our Bodies, Ourselves.
Well, first of all, I think I have to say that my activist sensibilities were stirred when I was a young girl, partly because I would hear about the Armenian Genocide. I had a great aunt who told me the story about her forced march across the desert. And my father told me stories about discrimination as a young Armenian man coming into the United States. He came actually from Marseille, France, where he had been for some years, speaking only Armenian and French. And it was that experience of discrimination and my listening to these stories that got me thinking about injustice in the world at a pretty young age. I was always concerned about these issues peripherally, but I was like any other kid. You know, I was doing sports, I played the cello, I was, you know, studying at school. We did have a little incident in eighth grade when a young black girl moved into Watertown, where I lived, Watertown, Massachusetts, and she was denied admission into Rainbow Girls.
And is this the early 1960s?
This is, let's see, very early 60s, you're right. Like 61. And I had no idea that Rainbow Girls and the Masonic Order was a racist organization, that it, you know, didn't allow blacks. My father had been a member. He'd gotten in, I think, after they stopped excluding people like Armenians. And he never said anything to me about this, though. And when we found out that this young girl couldn't join us, she was in our class, a few of us decided to write a letter to protest. And when ultimately they told us, oh, some lame excuse like, well, they make the rules in the South and we can't control that, then we decided to get up and quit. And it was my first kind of organized protest, I think. We quit Rainbow Girls because it was excluding one of us, you know, another eighth grader in our class. So those are the early experiences. And then, of course, I go to college and there's the Harvard strike and, you know. And
you were at Radcliffe.
I was at Radcliffe. But, you know, the last year or so was extremely contentious. And we had student-directed courses. We had people challenging the curriculum, challenging the role of Harvard in the community. And it was a very heady period. And I got, I wouldn't say a grounding in feminism, but a grounding in left-wing politics and analysis. I don't think I knew a feminist movement existed my whole undergraduate career. It's very interesting because as I was going to school, literally blocks away, people were meeting. And in fact, in 1969, there was that very important Women's Liberation Conference held at Emmanuel College at which the women who ultimately created Our Bodies, Ourselves first met. It was a workshop entitled Women and Their Bodies. And out of that workshop, women continued to meet, thought they'd do a list of good doctors in the area, wanted to talk about the hot health and sexuality topics of the day, and realized that they really couldn't do very much with evaluating local physicians in healthcare because they and we were all so ignorant about our bodies. So those meetings continued. There was a series of community courses created where mimeograph materials were shared and women added their stories, a little bit of research at the medical library, talking to physicians and nurses who were receptive. And it ended up with the 1970 publication, December of 1970, publication of Women and Their Bodies, which with the first reprinting became Our Bodies, Ourselves in early 71. Mm-hmm. I joined the group in 71 and in the fall. And it was serendipity. I had moved back from living communally for a year in upstate New York. I was very interested in social change. I was working with teens in an inner city setting, teaching auto mechanics to women and doing all kinds of interesting things. And lo and behold, one of the males in the group living situation was part of a men's group, which was also the men's group for Jane Pincus's husband, Ed Pincus. And Jane Pincus was one of the founding, early founding members of Our Bodies, Ourselves. I joined the group that fall just after I went to one meeting and fell in love with the women and the what was happening, and began to be part of the discussion to produce the next edition. These were all little newsprint booklets put out by the New England Free Press at that point. And we were beginning to have conversations with commercial publishers and thinking about expanding the topics. And there was nothing about nutrition in the early books. And that was my big issue. I had done organic farming and gardening, and I wanted to work on nutrition. So I basically married into this group. And these are some of my closest friends for the last almost 40 years. The reason why this book sold about 250,000 copies, word of mouth, as this little underground newsprint edition, is that there was so much condescension and paternalism and sexism in health and medical care. Women were so frustrated with lack of access to good care as they began to understand what good care was. But in the beginning, it was really the paternalism that bothered them. You ask a question, it was, you know, don't bother your pretty little head about it. I'll take care of everything. Women had postpartum depressions when nobody knew anything about them. Women couldn't get access to abortion because they weren't legal. Women had what we called VD, venereal disease in those days, now called sexually transmissible infections. And physicians knew very little about testing, diagnosis, and they knew very little about reinfection. And they often would tell the partner, the husband, that a woman had an infection without telling her herself. This was the kind of problem women were up against. And so the need for a book like this was phenomenal. And the self-help model that we used was, of course, replicated in other groups that started, you know, women-controlled health centers that began to advocate for women's health in a variety of arenas. We were very broadly focused. In fact, Our Bodies, Ourselves still continues to this day to be a multi-issue group. But other groups popped out of the women's health movement that focused on one issue, like infertility or endometriosis or breast cancer. And so it became a very interesting collection of organizations. And within the women's, larger women's movement, I would say that the social change perspective of the women's health movement and the unique ability of the women's health movement to steer clear of some of the horrible debates that really created so many schisms that women's groups broke up, never to reform again. I think the women's health movement kept a level of civilized conversation, even when we had disagreements, that enabled us to hang together over many years.
Why do you think that was?
I'm not sure. Even the pornography debate, we had a debate and people on different sides of the issue. And in our book, we decided to agree to disagree in some issues, and we presented pros and cons. I think because we were a varied group in the beginning in terms of where we were in our lives. Some women had given birth, you know, some years before. Others, like myself, had never given birth, weren't married, didn't know very much about our futures. We were more open to thinking about alternative visions, views, perspectives. There was a distinct lack of judgmentalism in many of these groups. And, of course, that was the cornerstone of Our Bodies, Ourselves. We wanted to get good information out to women, but then ultimately women were the best decision makers for what suited themselves. So we didn't want to tell women what to do. We wanted to give women good information. And over the years, we created a lot of projects with epidemiologists, people in the public health field, and we realized that this is really much more than demystifying what doctors do. It's about getting really hard questions about safety and efficacy, about the drugs we use, the surgical procedures that are performed, and getting access to the best available data. In those days, there were hardly any data available. We had so little good information about women's health that we were appalled once we began to look more closely at this. And in places like childbirth, there were routine interventions for which there was no evidence basis, things like routine episiotomy. Now, we know that that's not a great idea. Not only is it useless or not very helpful for the vast majority of women. It could actually do some harm. So episiotomy rates have fallen quite a bit. But there are other ways in which change has been slow to come. Mm-hmm. And that's where we've really struggled. The things that we've known to be true for a long time haven't gotten better, even with our level of activism.
So looking back again to those beginning times, how was the relationship within the group of women working on women's health issues different from the groups that had been working together on social causes previous to that, such as the civil rights movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement, and the beginning of the feminists, the second wave of feminism? How did things shift as people moved into looking specifically at women's health issues and access to health?
Well, I'm not sure that there were enormous differences between the women's movement and other movements for social change. In fact, many activists in the women's movement, and certainly in our group, came out of peace movement organizations. They came out of civil rights movement groups. They were, in some cases, distressed about the sexism in these organizations, where there wasn't equal sharing of power among men and women. And that was one of the frustrations that led to forming women's groups and led to asking that the power be shared within these other movements and these other organizations. But I think that one of the key differences between the women's health groups that I'm most familiar with and some of the larger women's movement organizations is that we often had very particular focus and a very particular agenda, like making abortion legal, getting access to safe and effective contraception, creating women's health centers. And the tasks at hand meant that we often had to be more practical, pragmatic, and less involved with the theory and the ideology. Not that we didn't have a theoretical underpinning to what we were doing. Certainly feminism was important, but it was a kind of definition that, you know, anybody who was a humanist could accept. You know, our definition was feminism was being a full human being in this world, you know, mm-hmm. and that meant recognizing women's talents and abilities to contribute to society at all levels. It meant that, you know, men would share in child rearing, women would share in other kinds of household tasks, that we liked breaking down stereotypes simply because it freed up men and women to think more broadly about who it is they could be, who it is they could become. And we certainly didn't like seeing our children being brought up with, you know, various stereotypical roles as their only sort of models. That, I think, being a focus helped us to become less judgmental, to be a little bit more accepting of different ways of looking at problems, different ways of defining solutions. We were always a group that paid a lot of attention to everybody's voice. And initially, we worked by consensus, which, of course, was impossible. When we first had a contract with Simon & Schuster, the poor publisher had to wait forever while we came to consensus about whatever topic was at hand. Eventually, we moved to a more traditional model of decision-making, whereby, you know, at first it was two-thirds, three-quarters, you know, of the group having to vote. And then ultimately, we adopted majority rules, because if you got stuck and you couldn't make a decision and you kept other people waiting, it didn't work. And when we did engage with the rest of the world who didn't fully appreciate our consensus process and they had deadlines and we couldn't, you know, we didn't have enough time to get to that place with a consensus process that might last weeks and weeks, we finally capitulated and said, okay, for at least certain decisions, we'll do majority rules, and then we'll have our answer to the publisher or whoever else needs it. And in fact, that is what consensus is about. You say, okay, I'm not in agreement, but I don't want to stop things.
I can live with this.
I can live with it because of other reasons.
You mentioned before that there was a real lack of knowledge and a lack of a research base on women's health. How did you begin to research the issues back in the 70s? And how does that compare with the overwhelmingness of information that we can access now?
Well, first of all, we weren't the only ones interested in this issue. We were wondering about all the hysterectomies. But when a health insurance company in New York City did a large study with some of the unions, actually, and determined that one-third to one-half of all the hysterectomies performed were unnecessary, we took a look at that and we said, maybe this is true elsewhere. And over the years, of course, we raised questions about the rising cesarean rate, which is now astronomical and totally unacceptable. But we were wondering then, why are things like hysterectomies on the rise? Why are women's ovaries, healthy ovaries, being removed at the time of a hysterectomy, say a necessary hysterectomy, when we didn't have any evidence of real benefit? The assumption was that, oh, well, you know, take out the ovaries when you're, you know, at menopause or beyond, because it's just an organ that could develop cancer, and why not get rid of it? And for many years, gynecologists thought they were doing women a service by doing so, having these prophylactic oophorectomies. And to his credit, a gynecologist at UCLA in Los Angeles was approached by one of the feminists who authored a newsletter called A Friend Indeed, a woman from Canada, who was very interested in midlife issues, menopause issues. And she wrote him a letter saying, why do you, as a profession, routinely take out women's healthy ovaries?
And again, this is mid-70s?
No, she wrote actually much later. The practice had been questioned, but I'm just talking about when things changed. Decades this went on. And I don't remember when she wrote to him. It was probably in the early 90s. Might have been late 80s, but I think it was early 90s. But anyway, some point, late 90s, maybe he started to get interested in this issue. The end result was an article published in the 2005 issue, I think, Obstetrics and Gynecology, in late in the year, whereby he and his colleagues did a huge meta-analysis and concluded that, yes, if you take a group of 10,000 women and you follow them from the age of 50 to the age of 80, you will save 47 deaths from ovarian cancer. But at the same time, you'll cause 838 deaths from cardiovascular disease and 158 deaths from osteoporosis, the fractures that lead to death. Basically, you'll kill 1,000 women to save 47 women. And he was floored by that. He's since done a reanalysis with other colleagues of the Nurses' Health Study, and they're going to be publishing soon very similar findings that suggest that these prophylactic oophorectomies not only don't do any good, they really do a lot of harm. So far, the prevalent practice hasn't changed, which we find fascinating too. There has not been what we would call a rational response to this evidence in the gynecological literature. And I'm glad the second study is coming out and that we're going to do more to reach women with the information, because that's one way you get physicians to think twice about what they've been doing for many years. Some of them don't read their own literature. Some of them may have missed an article. Some of them don't take it seriously, whatever. But when women are forceful and bring this data to their doctors, sometimes they look more carefully at it and a good dialogue gets going. We've certainly seen we've seen this right now with the vaginal birth after cesarean issue, which we'll get to later in our conversation, I hope. But it's one of the huge topics that's come out in public discussions around our new book, Our Bodies, Ourselves, Pregnancy and Birth.
So how did you, when you first began to do research in order to be able to study the different topics that were affecting women, things like birth control, nutrition, health care, you know, all the things that you were looking at in the 70s. How did you get your hands on the research? None of you were researchers per se.
Well, but we'd all been to college and we knew how to do a good term paper. We got permission to use Countway Medical Library at Harvard Medical School. We met with some of the physicians and nurses that were very receptive and responsive. We also saw that there were not data for a lot of things that were done. And when we asked questions, people said, yeah, we don't really know. We just do it. And we began the chorus, a growing chorus of voices saying, we've got to have a better evidence base for so much of what's done in women's health. And out of that chorus grew, of course, the Office of Research on Women's Health, which started around 1991. Some wonderful interdisciplinary research has begun, has taken place. We saw the big Women's Health Initiative get funded, and many studies out of that have informed us about things like hormone therapy and heart disease and breast cancer. We're still learning a lot more. And some of the original, dicta that we thought were, you know, the be-all and end-all, like women had to have their hormones around the time of menopause or else, we realized that, there's a small number of women, relatively small proportion of women, who stand to really benefit from taking hormones around midlife. And there are some real questions about what types of hormones and how much, and the whole estrogen and progesterone debate. But for many women, there is no need to take a hormone. For many women, menopause isn't a disease or a huge crisis. You know, there are a few hot flashes and flushes, but it's something that evens out over time, and medical intervention isn't required. And by the way, the routine use of these hormones for midlife women wasn't such a hot idea in terms of heart health and in terms of even breast cancer, although the risk is very minimal. And so we realized that certain things, like the assertion that taking hormones at midlife would reduce heart disease or heart attack. Those are things that women believe because we were using retrospective studies. We weren't using blue chip data. We were using somewhat faulty evidence where there was self-selection of the women in the studies and the already healthy women were the ones in the study. So we were thinking maybe, you know, taking hormones helps you to have better heart health. Well, that's not really true, as we've seen from the Women's Health Initiative.
You've spoken, I know, about the medicalization of the stages of women's life. And could you speak a little bit more? You've started that sort of talking about the hormone therapy. Can you speak a little bit more about that?
Well, we early on felt that, first of all, physicians and medicine already had been noted as an institution of social control over human beings. Ivan Illich wrote about it. My late husband, Irving Kenneth Zola, who was a pillar in the disability rights movement, wrote an article in 1966 entitled Medicine as an Institution of Social Control. Norma Swenson, one of the founders, co-founders of Our Bodies, Ourselves, took that idea and applied it to women and brought it into our group with a wonderful critical lens that we began to use with everything we looked at. And we realized that medicine was an institution of social control, and medicine often medicalized certain aspects of our lives, like menarche or childbearing or menopause, in ways that ultimately did not serve us well. And so these critiques emerged, and many sociologists and anthropologists were involved, both feminists and not feminists, involved in writing about this very issue. We are very concerned that excessive medicalization has led to overtreatment of the sort that costs us billions of dollars in this country and leads to worse outcomes. And I would refer all your listeners to Shannon Brownlee's excellent book, which came out in 2007, called Overtreated.
Has the way that we now perceive women's roles shifted enough to have an effect on the way we perceive healthcare and its effect on women?
It's really hard to answer that question because although I saw a sea change and women organizing, women taking pride in getting independent information, women doing research for themselves when they could, women organizing for change with men too. I mean, many of our books, by the way, involve male contributors. In the more recent past, what I've seen is a kind of what I refer to as opiate of the masses, a kind of excessive investment in the reality TV shows, you know, America's Next Best Top Model and the American Idol and the plethora of programs and movies that are, when you look at them, pretty shallow and pretty superficial, but take a lot of time and energy away from other kinds of exploration of issues, more in-depth discussions and, you know, analyses. Without these opportunities to look at diverse viewpoints, you grow up now in this culture with a very monotonic view of everything. It's not surprising to me that I meet so many young women. Yes, we've got everything out there. You can find it on the internet. But they haven't found it yet, and they haven't used resources like Our Bodies, Ourselves. I mean, there are women in college campuses where I go now who say, this is an amazing book. How come I've never seen it before? And they're graduating seniors. Or others say, I brought this book to my dorm in my freshman year. Nobody else had seen it, and it became, you know, everybody's resource. But what happened? You know, in my high school, everybody knew about it, but they're coming from communities where nobody knows about it. I think what we've seen is a suppression of this kind of really important information about sexuality, women's health, and it's been subsumed or replaced by, you know, websites and talk shows that talk about makeovers and, you know, everybody and her sister's getting a breast implant. Nobody's looking at the risks, especially of these silicone gel breast implants. And we work with a filmmaker, Carol Sansuti-Leva, who just did a fabulous documentary called Absolutely Safe. We were floored by the conversations in the college campuses that ensued with male and female audiences. It was a real eye-opener. There's such ignorance out there. It would boggle the mind.
What were some of the pieces of conversation that stand out?
Well, first of all, the assumption was these are totally safe procedures. And partly I blame plastic surgeons who don't do informed consent. They're not totally safe. And in other cases, they had no idea that there were serious risks posed and serious questions raised by all of the scientists who were at the FDA hearings talking about silicone gel breast implants. And that's almost invisible if you go to the implant manufacturers' websites or you go to the plastic surgeons' websites. You don't get a fair discussion of both known and unknown potential risks that every potential user of a silicone gel breast implant is entitled to. So we're using our website. There are other websites. There are this documentary as a means of getting the kind of word out there that normally you would find more easily. Even public television has not aired this film yet. It's high quality, and I won't go into the details right now, but I recommend that those of your listeners who are interested in the politics of what gets shown and not shown on public television look into this one, because it really ought to be shown somewhere on PBS.
You're listening to Profiles. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and our guest is Judy Nursejian. Judy is one of the co-founders of Our Bodies, Ourselves. Judy, we ask our guests to choose a song that is, or a couple of songs usually, that's in some way represents them or says something about them. And one of the pieces that you chose was Phil Oakes' Changes. Why did you pick that?
You know, I've always liked the lyrics, and I've always liked the way that he sang it. And I always think about life as, you know, it's like the merry-go-round. It's the circle. It's cyclical. And there are wonderful songs by women that come up with these themes. That's just the one that came to my mind when I was thinking about songs like that. But I like the fact that it acknowledges that we all go through changes. And I personally think that changes, even negative changes, can sometimes be turned around to be enriching life experiences. And so I see change as both positive, negative, and certainly eye-opening. And for me, someone who lost my, you know, soulmate, my true love, you know, the most incredible person I've ever met in my life, my husband, when I was only 47, he had a sudden heart attack. I went through a cataclysmic change. And then years later, actually 4 years later, after spending close to 7 years with my brother living with me, he died of a rare cancer. I saw someone I love die slowly, and that was a very different kind of change and loss that makes me think about songs like this a lot more. I listen to them, I resonate with them, and it's not just the aspect of loss. It's really that the loss produces a change in your consciousness about other things, and it happens gradually over time.
Sit by my side, come as close as the air. Share in a memory of gray, and wander in my words, and dream about the pictures that I play of changes. Green leaves of summer turn red in the fall. To brown and to yellow they fade, and then they have to die, trapped within the circle time parade of changes. Scenes of my young years were warm in my mind.
We've been listening to Phil Oakes' Changes, and you're listening to Profiles on WFIU. We're speaking with Judy Nursejian, one of the co-founders and co-authors of Our Bodies, Ourselves, a groundbreaking look at women's health, a groundbreaking book, and a groundbreaking approach to looking at women's health issues. Judy, talk to me a little bit more about the way that you see the shift in women's position in society affecting healthcare and the kinds of health care that a woman receives today. We talked a little bit about it from the idea of the media, but in terms of looking at it from women's roles.
Well, as I said earlier, we moved from a more passive stance with respect to our healthcare encounters to a more active, engaged stance. What I see now is many younger women moving back to a more passive stance and not realizing they have to ask questions. They have to be more proactive. I'm not sure totally where this comes from, but I certainly have this impression that we're moving back into the 50s in some ways, where there's a level of ignorance about key issues and not even the desire or even the awareness that you need to know more. And I'm not sure who to blame for this, but I think that the health outcomes are going to be worse because of it. We also have a lot of successes as well. And I want to say that the activism has produced results. We've got, for example, breastfeeding activists, lactivists, who've taken the research that's been done over many decades showing the benefits of breastfeeding. Mm-hmm. And they have moved towards getting laws passed that make it possible for women to breastfeed in public, you know, at a football game, at a baseball game, at a store, for women to have workplace-friendly policies. Oregon has the strongest breastfeeding legislation in the country right now. And one of the things that's so exciting is that I think we are seeing higher breastfeeding rates as women leave the hospital or have their birth in a birth center at home. Although 6 months later, we're not seeing sole breastfeeding, at least for 6 months. And that's the ideal way to feed a baby for the first 6 months of its life. We're seeing a really significant drop off. So it's gone down from, you know, 80-something percent to down to like 30%. We are having problems with retention. And I think that's because communities are still not supportive enough. Sometimes workplaces aren't. Sometimes women find it too complicated to go back to work and to nurse at the same time. Although many women do find it possible to express their milk and sometimes do, you know, 3, 4, 5 months after the baby's born, do some bottle feeding with breast milk and some bottle feeding with formula. It's interesting how each woman navigates this path her own way. But we've certainly seen some improved statistics in some communities. One of the ways you do this is you ban the bag, you know, the proverbial bag of free formula samples. Right. You don't send home a mixed message with a woman. You basically support the woman in breastfeeding. And if she needs to breastfeed or has to for some reason or chooses to for some reason, then, of course, you might give her some formula. But you don't routinely give it to everyone, suggesting that that's a fine and dandy way to feed your baby. Well, it's okay, but it's not the best way to feed your baby, and we have the evidence for that. It's not that you're going to hurt your baby, but you know, we did the book, you know, and had the breastfeeding or the feeding your baby chapter go out to readers. Some women were very concerned that we not use language that would make any woman feel guilty who might not be breastfeeding. So we were very careful to not make women feel guilty, but we also wanted to make sure that women had full information and that women knew that breastfeeding was the best way to feed your baby. And that's incontrovertible. It's a truth. And I think because we had so many readers catching every little place we might have led into that guilty feeling, we came out with language that is pretty successful because I've asked young women who are yet to become pregnant to read that chapter with an eye to, would you feel guilty if you chose not to breastfeed after reading this chapter? And so far, the uniform answer has been, no, I just got all the information I need and I'll make the choice that works for me. But I do get the message that breastfeeding is best. It's really important to me that women don't feel guilty for some of the choices that they make, but also that we give them accurate information.
Accurate and accessible information, I know, is one of the precepts. What are some of the other major concerns, health concerns, that you see facing women today?
Well, the environment is a huge issue. Global warming should be everybody's issue, obviously, but there are some very important studies now linking exposures to toxics in the environment, to reproductive ill effects, to other kinds of carcinogenic effects. We are now, through the benefit of many of these meta-analyses and reports that have been produced by scientists, not just in this country but in other countries, learning more about the toxic substances in cosmetic products and personal care products. And groups like the Environmental Working Group have produced reports like Skin Deep, and you can go to safecosmetics.org and plug in your very cosmetic product by brand name and find out if there are toxic or potentially toxic substances in it. And it tells you an alternative that you can use. It's not about not using these personal care products. It's about finding something that's safer that does the same thing. Some of the, you know, the dark brunette dyes, I forget what their chemical term is, but these are known to be carcinogenic. And there are alternatives. You can use henna dyes. You can use other kinds of dyes that aren't quite as known to be toxic. There are many, many things like that in personal care products. And there's also the plastics in the environment, the phthalates, the bisphenol A, and all of this is increasingly coming to the public's attention. We see more news items, and you know, I think there's a trickle down effect. But you've got to have education in the elementary school level. You've got to have people thinking about what cleaning products we use in the home. You know, what do we expose ourselves to? What kind of detergents do we use? The fabric softeners, those are a great source of problems, and yet people don't think twice about them. I think it's worth going to the internet reading about some of the, anti-static products that are put in these dryer sheets or whatever they're called, because I don't use them. But I know that I've read at the Environmental Working Group website some serious concerns that have been raised about these products, and they're not necessary to begin with. There are other ways to deal with static in clothes.
You had mentioned when we were speaking earlier as well about having a vaginal birth after having had a cesarean section, and that your group had been doing some work around that area as well.
Well, this book was a real challenge, but it was a very satisfying project. We begin the book with a chapter.
And the title of the book is?
It's Our Bodies, Our Cells, Pregnancy and Birth. The chapter begins talking about creating a climate of confidence rather than a climate of doubt, because prevailing cultural messages have led so many younger women to be fearful of pregnancy, to be fearful of birth, and into thinking bizarre things like having a cesarean will help me escape from the pain of labor. You might avoid the pain of the labor that day, but boy, the pain of recovery is so substantial, according to all the women I know who've had cesareans. It's no piece of cake. Plus, when you take enough painkillers so you're not in pain, you're not really fit to be holding your baby sometimes because you're so woozy. So it's a complicated situation post-cesarean. But the issue, sometimes cesareans are needed. They're very important when they're needed. We have too many cesareans done. We talk about the reasons for that in our book. But the real crisis I see right now is once a woman has had a cesarean and does a lot of reading, and we've got volumes now on the increased risk to the mothers with subsequent births done by cesarean. They are seeking out vaginal births after cesarean, at least half or more of the women, by the survey done by Harris Interactive for the Childbirth Connection in New York City, more than half were denied a VBAC option, vaginal birth after cesarean option, when close to half wanted that. I think this is a crisis of significant proportions. I would consider it a human rights crisis, because if you look at one of the biggest studies that came out of Canada just this past year, where they looked at 30,000 women who'd had a primary cesarean, and about half went on to have a subsequent planned cesarean birth, and the other half went on to have what we call a trial of labor, hoping they'd have a vaginal birth, and a small number of them did have a cesarean birth, even though they hoped for a vaginal birth, but about 85% or more would end up with a successful vaginal birth. Well, what they found in that group of more than 30,000 women is that there were 6 maternal deaths, and 5 of them were in the planned cesarean group. Only one was in the VBAC group. And that was not because of a ruptured uterus, which is what many women think is the biggest thing to fear. Though the uterus can rupture, an emergency cesarean usually can avoid any adverse consequences, and the baby is usually fine. In this case, it was a hemorrhage. And one of the 5 deaths in the planned cesarean group was a hemorrhage as well. Those are rare things, but they do happen. One of the things that women are going to be asking for more and more in the coming years, and what they're going to find that they can get less and less of, is a VBAC. And one of the reasons we've got this problem is the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists has a really problematic statement that says hospitals should not offer VBACs unless they have anesthesiologists 24/7 in the facility. And I know physicians who've written to ACOG asking that they reverse this position, who know that this is not in the best interest of the women. But the lawyers in these hospitals are saying, if ACOG has this position, we're uncomfortable having you do VBACs in this hospital. Would you please get ACOG to reverse the position? I hope that they will. If they don't, there's actually a very large growing chorus of women in this country, and lawyers included, thinking about a class action suit.
Thinking about that as a specific example, how does that fit into the larger issue of universal health care?
Well, this is a huge issue. Many of us certainly want universal health care. I personally don't think that the Massachusetts approach, the individual mandate approach, is one that would work. I think, in fact, the only thing that will work is a single-payer approach. I know this is politically a hard row to hoe. I know that many of our political leaders privately know that a single payer is the best system that we really ought to create, but there are powerful moneyed sources like the drug industry and the insurance industry that certainly don't want to see single payer. But it's going to get a little bit more discussion and attention. The AMA certainly hasn't come out in favor of single payer, but the second largest medical group in the country, the American College of Physicians, last December in 2007 made a big splash, I thought, with a press conference and a press release endorsing the single payer approach. And there was a resounding silence in most of the major media. They did not cover this news story. I wonder why.
Some of the issues, as we're talking, are so huge and so large, and you've been at this for a long time. What's something that sustains you to keep going with the energy that I hear coming through as we're talking?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think the thing that excites me the most is the activism among young people, college students, grad students, people in their 20s, and yes, others as well. I mean, a lot of my closest colleagues are in my cohort, late 50s, 60s. But I have to say, I am so excited by the smarts, the intuitive and strategic thinking that many young people use, the sophisticated use of the internet. Of course, we're actually seeing elections won with sophisticated use of the internet these days, not just in this country. And I'm impressed with what I've seen as creative use of minimal resources and an understanding that actually access to the mainstream media is not going to be possible for the truly radical voices. They're going to have to get the word out other ways, and they're going to have to be creative, and they're going to have to be clever, and using every tool at our fingertips is vital. And I see this all the time, and I have to say that really inspires me, that despite these enormous well-funded interests that don't always serve women's health interests well, we've also got a cadre of very talented young women and men who are committed to sexual and reproductive rights, that are going to make sure that abortion stays legal and safe, that they're going to be sure that all these other issues, whether they're breast cancer or high infant mortality rates in the African-American community or whatever the issue, that we're going to be putting a focus on these issues and do something about it. Ultimately, poverty is the single greatest determinant of poor health. And if we could eradicate poverty in this country, we would do more than we could do by any other means towards improving our community health and well-being.
I know throughout the years that the group Our Bodies, Ourselves has made an effort to include more voices, different ages, different races, different ethnicities, different sexualities, and has really put a strong emphasis on that. But as the book has been translated into other languages and other cultures, how have you translated some of the situations that face women so that it becomes something that's understandable across situations?
Well, first of all, it's important to know that we didn't start any of these projects. The book is now in, of course, 23, 24 foreign editions. But every single instance involved a women's group coming to us and saying, there's stuff in this book that's vital for us. We want to take it and make it our own. Now, in the early days, there were more or less straight translations. Some of the feminists in Germany and Italy and France and in the UK made minor modifications, but in the Netherlands, Sweden, but they basically did a similar book. More recently, women have made significant cultural adaptations. The first really significant cultural adaptation was the Spanish language adaptation, Nuestros Cuerpos, Nuestras Vidas, which came out in 2000 with Seven Stories Press. It's still available, but we're hoping to get funding to do a new edition with updated information of this book and make it available not just to Spanish-speaking women in the United States and Canada, but also throughout Latin America. But the women in other countries have had different challenges in, you know, Muslim countries, in conservative African cultures. Women describe very different challenges. And, of course, in some places they don't even want to do books. They want to do pamphlets or posters for the canoe system in Nigeria. That they want to make sure that the medium fits the setting. And so the solution is not a book, but a lot of little resources. And in some cases, it's not even a book at all that you pick up. The Russian women decided to do a completely electronic edition because there are so many kiosks, there's availability, access to the internet. But paper's so expensive, women couldn't probably buy a book that would be that big. So they've produced an electronic edition. There are groups of women in Nepal, in Jerusalem, Palestinian and Jewish Israeli women working on two editions, Hebrew and Arabic. Groups of women in Turkey, in Armenia, they're doing their second edition. Eastern Europe has a number of editions. We're working with women in West Bengal, doing a Bangla edition for women there and in Bangladesh. I mean, when we say we're working with them, we provide technical assistance, information as they need it, sometimes help with fundraising. They have the challenge of doing the cultural adaptation. We also back-translate portions, or they back-translate portions of what they produce into English so that readers in other parts of the world can see what they've done with the book. And we're hoping that many of these editions will be available online as a foreign language edition for anyone in the diaspora. You know, there are women from French-speaking Africa who are in the United States who want to see the book that was produced in Senegal but is hardly available in the U.S. They'd love to see that online.
Mm-hmm. What is something that you think is really important for women to pass on to their daughters or nieces or friends' children? What's something that you've gleaned from your years of experience of being involved in women's health issues that you think it's really important to pass on?
Well, I think it's really important to have an involvement or passion that brings in the larger community in some way, whether it's your school, environmental issues, whether it's global health, trafficking in human beings. It doesn't matter what it is, but there has to be something that engages you beyond the walls of your house. I believe that the healthiest, most energizing lives are lives lived with an awareness of what's going on outside of our immediate household. And we can get drawn into so many tasks of keeping, you know, a clean house and taking care of our kids and, making sure there's enough food on the table. These things are all important. But I think we need time to spend on these other involvements that are bigger than ourselves and our immediate families, that connect us to our larger community and the world out there, that if we don't expand that awareness, I think that as a society, as a global society, we have less chance of making all of this work, that we all have to see outside, beyond our immediate needs and narrow focus, to recognize there's a common humanity there, commonality of needs and concerns and issues, so that we don't see so much xenophobia and homophobia and racism. That's one way we start to address these isms, by looking at the world with a broader lens. Take on introducing a differently abled, curriculum in your local school so that students grow up learning about disabilities, even if they're not going to school with kids with disabilities. Do something about anti-racism work. There's all kinds of resources out there, groups, the internet. And there's the Polaris Project, which is focusing on human trafficking in the United States. It's not just an international issue that takes place in other countries. So many great projects. We link to them at our website, ourbodiesourselves.org. We also have a great blog, Our Bodies, Our Blog, if you want to get Yes, go to ourbodiesourblog.org and ask to be sent a terrific short digest of critical new information about women's health happenings. We really love to digest what we learn about and send it back to our readers. We're also avid fans of womensenews.org, and we send people there a lot. They cover women's health quite a bit. You're not going to get women's health information that's meaningful from just the mainstream network news sources. Even public television and radio is inadequate now. You've got to go to other sources as well.
Judy, thank you so much for being our guest on Profiles. We've been speaking with Judy Norsegian, one of the co-authors and founders of Our Bodies, Ourselves, as well as the Boston Women's Health Book Collective. Judy, you chose Whitney Houston's The Greatest Love of All. Why that song?
Well, in part because it's about children, and I love children, and I've spent a lot of time with children, and I think we have to teach our children to love themselves first and foremost, but not in a narcissistic way. There's a lot of self-hating going on. There's a lot of cultural messages about not liking your body if you're a young girl. I think it's led to a lot of the eating disorders that we see now. So it's about really embracing children, welcoming them, letting them be children, and helping them love themselves first and foremost. I think that's why I like it.
Judy, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
I believe the children are our future. Teach them well and let them lead the way. Show them all the beauty they possess inside. Give them a sense of pride to make it easier. Let the children's laughter remind us how we used to be. Everybody searching for a hero. People need someone to look up to. I never found anyone who fulfilled my needs. A lonely place to be. And so I learned to depend.
The program you have just heard was recorded in May of 2008. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. More information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website at wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.